This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. And there's an audience with us here in the night studio. And thanks very much for coming in. We appreciate it. Roy Blunt Jr.'s new book about words invites browsing. Open to page 267 and you'll find sesquipedalian, which he writes describes a long, uncommunicative word used for the sake of showing off. For instance, pogonomy for shaving. Back on page 113, there's glottis, another word for the vocal apparatus of the larynx, but you don't learn it in school, Blunt writes, because the class, okay, the boys, would find it comical. If, as many scientists argue, our brains are hardwired for language, Roy Blunt Jr. says the current that flows through those filaments is alphabet juice, the quirky but venerable squiggles which, through centuries of knockabout breeding and intimate contact with the human body, have absorbed the uncanny power to carry the ring of truth. Later in the program, hold the presses. Murray Horwitz joins us here in the museum to talk about the great newspaper, radio, and TV news movies of all time. You can send us your nominations now by email. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, if you'd like to talk with Roy Blunt Jr. about the origins of words and language, about the words you love to roll off your tongue, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Roy Blunt Jr. is here with us at the museum. The full title of his new book is Alphabet Juice, The Energies, Gists, and Spirits of Letters, Words, and Combinations Thereof, Their Roots, Bones, Innards, Piths, Pips, and Secret Parts, with Examples of Their Usage, Foul, and Savory. And thank you for letting me read that line.
If you have a long enough subtitle, you don't really have to answer any questions.
And you don't have to write much of a book either.
Sorry, yeah.
This is, in fact, sort of a generational quest for you. You have ancestors who were in this business.
Yeah, my great, very distant 17th century ancestor, Thomas Blunt, Sir Thomas Blunt, put out the first dictionary that went into etymology at all. It didn't go into etymology very well, but it did trace the roots of words. It came out in 1600-something, and it was called Blunt's Glossographia.
And yours is a glossographia as well.
Yeah, why not? Glossa for word and graphia for scratching and writing.
And your argument, fundamental argument, is indeed that the sounds of words do have connections with their meaning.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true of simple words like through. A lot of people don't like to think about what goes on in their mouths very much, but if you...
There's tongues in there.
Yeah, you know, as Robert Beasley described, the tongue is that awful-looking thing right back of your teeth. But when you say the word through, you start out in the front of your mouth and go straight back, and then there's a little breath that bounces back out, through. It's a very through-some word, and compare that to thwart, which starts out like through, but then that W jumps back up in front of you and slows you down, and then ends in a T, which is... ends in a wart, as a matter of fact. And then there's the word throttle, which starts out like through, but then gets it back into your glottis back there, and it's like being, a little bit like being strangled.
Throttle. Yeah. Wow. You came up with a word for the ways that sound can affect the meaning of words, sonicky.
Sonicky, yeah. The trouble with the word onomatopoeia, linguists will say, okay, there's onomatopoeia, like in snap, crackle, and pop, but there's more than that going on. And one problem is that onomatopoeia is not a very onomatopoeic word. It doesn't say anything. So I use the word in this book, the word sonicky, which sort of, I like, it has a K in it for one thing, which is always good.
It sounds a little like a hamburger you might get at a takeout place.
Sonicky, I like to have a K because it's the sound it's got that sound, which is either telling a horse to go or someone who appeals to you to let you approach.
Now, you argued that all language at some level is body language, all English is body English, and who wants a tongue to be cut and dried? And I just made a note in my book saying, the Germans.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're different. If you look at... the different words, one thing linguisticians have said is that, let me just mention pig noise. They say that words are not, that the relationship between words and their meaning is arbitrary because pig noise is, in English, is oink, and in Norway, it goes something like nuf, nuf, or something. And in Russian, Steven Pinker says, in Russian, pigs go C-H-R-J-U or something. Who knows how that's pronounced? So you know what? I Googled Russian pigs go, and I found out that in Russian, pigs go H-R-O-O, H-R-O-O. Note that these are rolled R's, and the H is more of a H-K sound, like when you try to build a loogie. Don't try and pronounce the K, just phlegm up the H. So I think that's pretty good pig noise, if you ask me. And it sort of fits in with oink. Pigs make various noises.
Phlegm is a pretty good word, too.
Phlegm is a pretty good, especially if it's got that G in there, that silent G, but you know it's in there, and you know it's going to come up hard when you say phlegmatic.
We're talking with Roy Blunt, Jr., about his new book, Alphabet Juice. Junior is also a word that you write about in this book. You probably have a lot of experience with it.
Yeah, someday I'm going to write the great junior book. You know, both of our, whoever gets elected president is going to be a the namesake of his father, both McCain and, not only that, but both vice presidents. Biden is a junior, and Sarah Palin's mother was called Sally, but her name was Sarah. And and something like 38-39% of American presidents have been named for their father, for their fathers. And it's an interesting thing. What it boils down to is when you're call on the phone when you're an adolescent boy. You answer the phone, and they say, who's this? And you say, George. And they say, Big George or Little George?
Little George,
and
yeah.
And you hate that the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And we have seen a junior presidency and a half most in the last 8 years.
I'm actually the third, and I got Little Neil through my whole childhood. Absolutely despised it.
Richard Cheney, well, you can imagine what he got.
Let's get some callers on the line if you'd like to join our conversation with Roy Blunt, Jr. about words and how their sounds affect their meaning. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's start in South Bend, Indiana, with Angela.
Hi. First, I'd like to say I love Talk of the Nation. It's my favorite show. I listen to it all the time. But I recall, this was maybe a year ago, I started dating a guy, and picked me up for the first date and told me that I looked deciduous. And I thought that he was a moron because of the meaning.
Things were
of
falling
deciduous.
Off of you? Or?
In the fall?
Yeah. No, it was in February, actually. But what he later explained to me, because I guess he caught the look on my face, he explained that he really dug the sounds of words as opposed to the meanings. And I'm an English lit major. I I'm very into etymology and like the origins and meanings and whatever derivatives. And he was very much about sounds. And he went on to explain about certain sounds sounded sexy or certain sounds of words made him hungry, whatever. And so from then on, it's become my favorite word. Like whenever I'm, I guess for the radio audience, I guess frisky would be the word. Deciduous comes into mind. It was just one of the most sensual things that any guy has ever said to me.
A lot of things depend on context.
Indeed, and it sounded like he talked himself out of a good one.
Yeah, I think that's so. Yeah. You didn't have any leaves in your hair that were falling out or anything.
No.
Well, the S is nice, deciduous. And, you know, I think there are sexier words than deciduous, but each of us must decide these things for him or herself.
Angela?
I think also if you whisper it, it's
yeah, well, whisper, yeah.
Angela, have a deciduous day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get Laura on the line. Laura is calling from Fresno, California.
Hi. I'm just actually driving all over the place, and I always listen to you when I drive. And I was thinking about words, and that I have a 2-year-old little boy, and his favorite word is beautiful. And he likes to say, if he looks nice, that he's beautiful. And my other children always say to him, no, 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 you're a boy. You're supposed to be handsome. And he says, no, 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 I'm beautiful. And I just think it's really interesting how we attach kind of this gender to our words and where that started that, and why it is that so many people think that you're pretty if you're a girl, or you're beautiful if you're a girl, but you have to be handsome as a man. And I just made me think about words and the subject and kind of where that came from.
Have any ideas? Of course, English doesn't have a male or female usages in its language.
Well, handsome has to do with hands, and maybe men earn that. And so, with in relation, maybe men can't keep their hands off of beauty. I don't know.
That's as good an answer as we're going to get. Laura, drive safely, please.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. There are so many outstanding words in this, but I have to say when we come back, we're going to be talking about some of your favorite one, two, and three-word sentences because they come together absolutely beautiful. And we're just going to read the collection of great one-word sentences before we go away from the break. Forget about it. That's a good one. Come here, touche, look. And you write the actual last line of the Maltese Falcon, which is not, as most people believe, Humphrey Bogart's "This is the stuff that dreams are made on," but Ward Bond's response.
Huh?
One of the great questions in journalism,
too. In fact,
too.
I think that's the... no one knows what the first word ever was, but I think the second word was, huh?
Huh? Roy Blunt, Jr. is with us. His new book is entitled Alphabet Juice, and just because it's so deciduous, I'm going to read the whole subtitle again. The energies, gists, and spirits of letters, words, and combinations thereof, their roots, bones, innards, pits, pips, and secret parts, tinctures, tonics, and essences, with examples of their usage, foul and savory. If you'd like to discuss any of those words or their usage, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. It's not just individual words that Roy Blunt Jr. savors in his new book. He also picks out some of his favorite sentences. We just mentioned some of his favorite one-word sentences. Here are great three-word sentences. Omit needless words. Ain't she sweet? The game's afoot. Call me Ishmael. Baby, it's you. And they're off. I got it. And Roy Blunt Jr., apropos of the day the World Series gets underway, there's a story after I got it.
Yeah, Red Smith once wrote that there was a very stuck-up, I guess he was a third baseman named Bill Werber, who was a stickler for correct usage, and he insisted that you shouldn't yell, I got it, you should yell, I have it, which is ridiculous. he would tell his teammates, no, it's wrong, that's wrong, it's I have it. So that's a good example of how got it is a lot more persuasive. And, if somebody says, I have it, you don't think they've got it.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Oh, actually, we have a questioner here at the Newseum. Go ahead.
Hi, Chadwick Vale from Storrs, Connecticut. I was just wondering if you could speak to the fact that we're getting a lot more Spanish immigrants and the influx of Spanish-speaking people and how that might be changing the way we speak here in the U.S.
I wonder, can we think of any Spanish words that have sort of entered into common parlance more lately since the influx? I'm trying to think of some.
We'll have to come back with some mañana.
Yeah, mañana. it's bound to. And Spanish words, the big enchilada we already had so in politics. I don't know. I'm trying to think of any. Can you think of an emerging Spanish term that's worked its way into the language? A lot of new restaurants, I know that.
I'm not sure about that. I was wondering if you had any generalizations for where we're going or if there's going to be any broad way to
explain about English, and especially American English, is that how many influences it has had and how many influences it has absorbed and made use of. Everything from Yiddish to Shoshone have added words to English or changed English words. And there, in fact, English has three times more words than any other language. So it's always been, it's a great example of e pluribus unum. And I don't know how many there are left anymore, but the language is.
Let's get Michael on the line. Michael with us from San Francisco.
Hi. Roy, it's a great pleasure to get a chance to talk with you.
Good. How are you doing?
I had a couple of, a unique one comes from Hebrew, and the word is bakbuk, which is the word for bottle. But if you think about an old bottle pouring out the water or wine in it, that's the sound it makes.
Oh, yeah, bakbuk,
it goes back and forth, right? Bakbuk, bakbuk, bakbuk.
Oh, yeah.
And on the kind of three-word sentences is a New Yorkism, where they love to merge three words into one word. JeetJet?
JeetJet, yeah.
JeetJet, right, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about...
Or the more famous one, Forget About It.
Forget yeah, About It, yeah. We
mentioned
that
earlier, yeah.
Forget About It.
And this is, I wish I could claim that this was original. In English, we have shower, right? You turn on the water and you have shh, and you get in right, and it's too hot, you and you say, ow, ow, shower. But that's there a famous go. Mel Brooks
oh, yeah?
Piece, yeah.
Yeah. George Carlin talked a lot about words, too, and how somebody says, I'll be back in 15 minutes, you think they will. But if they say, I'll be back in 20 minutes, you think there's no telling how long.
How long it's going to be. That's right.
Well, Hebrew's got another one. They have a word, rega, which is literally an undefined unit of time.
Oh, yeah.
So rock is only. So they say rock rega, which could mean 5 seconds or, you know, a year and a half.
Michael, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email that we have from Ryan in Virginia. My favorite word is ethereal. Does Roy know the background of this lofty adjective?
Ethereal, well, there's the ether, you know. I don't know what the etymology exactly is, but the ether is what we're talking out into right now.
Our radio waves are spreading through the ether.
Through the ether. Now, why people then apply that to... the stuff that used to put people to sleep. I don't know why. Maybe, I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
I think it's Greek.
Oh, I think it probably is Greek, yeah. But what it meant in Greek originally, I don't know, but probably air. And ethereal, of course, is airy and insubstantial.
We just got a note from our producers, Hasta la vista.
Hasta la vista, yeah. Yeah,
there you go.
But that was Clint Eastwood's, not from Mexico, I don't think.
Yeah. Let's get Rock on the line. Rock from Payson, Arizona.
Hello, Neil and Roy.
Hi.
Enjoyed listening to both of you for many years.
Well, thank you for that.
Enjoy both of your humorous attitudes, too. I was telling your screener that I ended up, after graduating from school, from college and that, with an English minor and art major, discovering how deficit my vocabulary was, so I picked up a book named Word Power Made Easy, threw it in my fishing tackle box, and after going through it about four times, it entranced me so much with Greek, Latin, and prefixes and suffixes and all that that I started teaching this to my students with flashcards, and in spite of themselves, they became very astute students of etymology.
Oh, good for you. Did you catch any fish?
Well, yeah. This was a good thing because they, in the slow times, it really helped me. Roy, what was the name of that book of yours again?
Alphabet Juice, and thank you
Alphabet
for asking.
Alphabet Juice?
Yeah. Alphabet Juice. Yeah, you want me to hear a quote from Mark Twain, which sort of talks about the power of words. A powerful agent is the right word. Whenever we come upon one of those intensely right words in a book or a newspaper, the resulting effect is physical as well as spiritual and electrically prompt. I think that's just a wonderful electrically prompt. We've got all sorts of electrically prompt media now, but... the words, a word on a page can be electrically prompted, too.
Well, I think what I enjoy so much about you, and that is your down-home sense of humor. You take a very lofty subject, which is basically a lot of Greek and Latin, and you bring it down to the everyday, every man's level.
Well, thank you. Maybe I should run for something, but I don't know.
This would be the time to announce. Rock, yeah. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Here's an email from Bob in Madison, Connecticut. My wife cannot stand the sound of the word moist. When I was told a coworker had a word she hated but wouldn't say what it was, I said, is it moist? I thought she was going to throw up right there on the sidewalk. Why do people have such strong reactions to certain words?
Moist is a very sonic-y word. I mean, it's you hear a lot of moisture in there. I don't want to name the sort of moisture there is, but some people just don't like to think about what goes on, as I say, in their mouth.
And it's interesting, that word comes up in your, you take issue with the phrase dry humor.
Oh, yeah, because humor originally is the same root as humid, and it had to do with fluids. And so, people just often say, he's got that dry humor. That dry humor. If I like it to be a little, I'm not going to say moist, but I like for humor to be a little juicy.
Let's get Julie on the line. Julie with us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call in when you were talking about the Russian word for a pig sound, and you say it like this, clue, clue.
Clue, clue. Well.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're going to spit like you're clearing your throat, and then you add like an L-O-O behind it, because my husband's Russian, and I hear this sound sometimes right. when they're talking about it.
And how do the Russian pigs learn this?
I think most things in German sound, I mean in Russian sound like that, don't they? There's a lot of that element of in there in the back of the mouth. And I appreciate that because I think it sounds like a pig. I don't know. Maybe not. But oink and oink sound like, and grunt works for me, actually.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. Julie, let's get somebody here on the microphone at the museum.
Mark Aiklin, Washington, D.C.
Go ahead, please.
Mr. Blunt, do you believe that email and texting are impairing the language?
Well, they're, like everything else, they're impairing it and adding things to it, too. But, yeah, I think that people are in such a hurry to text and email that they leave out. I saw the other day on urbandictionary.com, which is a resource I recommend, an interesting thing online. But somebody said that people are now, the word awesome has just been horribly overused. And now somebody said that, that people, instead of texting awesome, they're texting just A-W-E-S, just aws. And that really cuts awesome down to size, I think.
Pay no attention to that word behind the curtain.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Here's an email we have. This is Erica from Phoenix, Arizona. I find myself discombobulated by today's program.
Yeah, that's a good word, I think.
That's a good one. Yeah. Two-word sentence from Tom in St. Louis. From War and Peace, drops dripped.
Drops dripped. Ooh, from War and Peace. Of course, in Russian, I don't know. That would probably be more like drops dripped. I don't know.
My favorite word of this political season, writes Matt in Cypress, Texas, is bloviate. It is almost an onomatopoeia.
Yeah, it is. I think it captures somehow the false expansiveness of empty hot air language.
And this from Amy in Shinglehouse, Pennsylvania. That's a pretty good word too. My husband and I love the word obsequious. It is just so great. So when we are describing someone as having been obsequious, we say the obsequity of the person was beyond belief. For example, words are great and so much fun to play with. Our kids are starting to play with words too, which can make the dinner table a very fun place to be.
Hmm. Yeah, obsequious. You get seek in there. You kind of sneaking a seek in there.
Let's get Pavel on the line. Pavel with us from Laramie in Wyoming.
Hi there, everybody. Years ago, when I worked for the Wyoming Geological Survey, one of our main guys would always come into the tickets at the office and say, "Let's go have lunch." His way of saying it was a single word, squeet.
Squeet,
like
yeah,
S-Q-E-E-T,
yeah.
Squeet.
Squeet, yeah, yeah.
A squeet. And by the way, this gentleman's name on the level is Forrest Root.
Ah.
That's the man's name, Forrest Root.
Well, that's nice. And what is he doing now?
Well, I have no idea. It's been years since I worked under a great Squeak. State geologist, Dan Miller, and I have no idea where Forrest is, or the trees, for that matter.
Forrest Root. I always thought the word Wyoming should be a gerund. You know, we've been... There should be a verb to Wyoming.
I had no idea.
Or it's part of a split something? Infinitive to blank Wyoming.
I'm not even going to go there. Yeah. I have a question for you, Roy, though.
Yeah.
Should words ever be taken literally?
Should words ever be taken literally? Well, that's kind of a lot. You mean... Well, you can be too literal about words, but that it's sort of, you know, if you say, I like for words to be taken as literally as possible. I like for people to try to use words as literally as possible. And one word I like for people to use literally is the word literally, which they so often use to mean figuratively. I literally fell through the floor. You know, it's just not true.
Well, a final thing from me, sir, on a romantic note. The young lady earlier who talked about how much she just treasured and enjoyed the word deciduous as applied to a human instead of to a tree, my dear sweet girlfriend, she loves the word verdant. Verdant. Now verdant doesn't necessarily mean, for her, verdant, and now for me as well, is a very sensuous word, I think because of its sound.
Huh, verdant. It sounds...
Verdant.
Uh-huh. Would you name someone verdant? I don't know. It's well, no. if it works for you two, I'm happy for you.
Well, wasn't he a friend of President Clinton's, Verdon Jordan?
Verdon Jordan, yeah. Verdon.
Yeah. Pavel, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
We're My talking, pleasure. I'm a great listener. Thanks. Bye.
Sort Thank of like you. Hydrant or something. I don't know.
We're talking with Roy Blunt Jr. about his new book, Alphabet Juice. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we have someone at the microphone here at the museum.
Hi, I'm Jana from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to know if you think it's inherently pretentious to use words that are bigger than commonly used.
Well, I don't know. How big would that be, do you think?
Depends on the circle. Sometimes exactly. Pretentious is a big word, and
there you go, yeah.
Sometimes obscure is too big for the common crowd.
Well, I don't think that the length of a word is necessarily a sign of its pretentiousness. You know, discombobulate is kind of a fun word, and it's kind of long. It's pretentious to use words that don't mean anything, that's for sure, and a lot of people do. I think that people probably don't take enough risks in politics, at any rate, these days. People don't, you know, people are so afraid. The only thing anybody remembers anymore is gaffes. I think that people don't try to use sort of strong, tangy words in politics very much. I noticed yesterday that, or in the New York Times today, Barack Obama used the word ain't. He said, I don't want to get this right. He said, I don't think it's right. In fact, it ain't right. And that ain't is a great old word. It's not pretentious. And it used to be standard back in the 18th century. And it works a lot better. I mean, if in song titles, for instance, it isn't necessarily so, or that isn't me, babe, or eminent misbehaving. This doesn't work. So, but I think you can have a lot of fun with words, and that pretentiousness can be fun too. So I don't rule out pretension as long as you work in some short words with it.
And I'll be happy to use that word ain't as long as my third grade English teacher is nowhere in the room and not near
right.
a piece of
That's
chalk.
Right.
Here's an email from Allison in Cincinnati. My daughter had some language issues as a small child and frequently get words mixed up. She invented a few of her own, which I love. A remembery, which I thought of as a very logical contraction of memory and remember. And 11-teen, which comes, of course, after 10.
Yeah, 11-teen. The derivation of the word 11, by the way, is really cool. I can't quite remember what it is, but it's something I'm not even going to go into. But it really, look up 11 sometime. Words like that that you take for granted often just sort of jump up at you when you find out how they were cobbled together. You know?
Let's get Mary on the line. Mary calling us from Syracuse in New York.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
My word is, I love the word hebetudinous.
Ooh, that's beauty or something like that? What's
hebetudinous? It's like stupid.
Oh,
it's
it
like
is?
A long way of saying stupid.
Oh, I didn't know that. Hebetudinous.
It was on Gilligan's Island where I first heard it. I was about 7 years old.
They didn't have a dictionary on Gilligan's Island, I don't think. But
no, nope, just the professor.
Yeah, the professor made that one up.
Yeah. Well, it's similar to Bugs Bunny's favorite expression. What a maroon.
There you go.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Mary. And we're not going to have time to get him on the air, but what's your favorite word, asks Mark in Hartford, Connecticut, that's changed its meaning?
Oh, favorite word that has changed its meaning? Well, people ask me, I have a stock answer to what's my favorite word, which is chicken. But a word which has changed, an example of a word that has changed its meaning because of the sound of it is demeaning. It used to be that to demean yourself was to just sort of behave yourself, and it's the same root as the word demeanor. But just because mean was in there, which mean you know, people nowadays means it's to sell yourself short or to allow yourself to be...
Run for political office.
So that's an example of the sound of words, but that's certainly not my favorite word. I like words that I hope words hold their own and their own meaning.
And now movies that chronicle the chroniclers, films about journalism. Those of us that labor in the Fourth Estate can't imagine any other place we'd rather be. Here's Jimmy Cagney as reporter Lou Marsh talking to his boss, Raymond Massey, in his office at his beloved newspaper.
Well, it's been quite a day, one that neither of us will forget in a hurry. I think we could both do with a little rest. Can I drop you off at your home?
Don't you see, Mr. Ives? I am home.
From 1951's Come Fill the Cup. Home for reporters in the movies can be the newsroom, the press conference, a parking garage, or a battlefield. In the movies, the reporter may be a trench-coated foreign correspondent, an ink-stained wretch, or just a plain wretch. And, of course, sometimes it's that brunette stick of dynamite Rosalind Russell. Murray Horowitz knows a thing or two about both journalism and the movies, and definitely about Rosalind Russell. He joins us now for a special museum edition of our mostly summer but sometimes fall movie festival series. Murray, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Neil, in a place that, among other things, has an exhibit in which you appear. I noticed somebody.
Well, yes, they were silly enough to put a picture of me up
right
in there.
You're incarcerated in the museum.
And I should mention Roy Blunt Jr. is still with us, whose hands have been ink-stained from time to time.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, they are at the moment.
Well, would you have called yourself a sports journalist when you were Sports Illustrated?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I've talked to people who work for magazines, and they talk about the media.
Right.
And I say, well, you're in the media. And they say, no, I'm I always thought I was in one of the media, yeah.
Murray, there's a lot of different kinds of newspaper, radio, and television news, movies. Some of them sort of inside baseball, about the business itself.
Right. There are a few categories. There's this wonderful quote. In fact, I used to have a T-shirt that said this. It was from Oscar Wilde, a quotation, not a quote, right, Roy?
Well.
And it said that the difference between journalism and literature is that journalism's unreadable and literature's unread. It's certainly not unwatchable. There is a huge number of movies about journalism or in which journalism figures. So we've broken them down into about a long number of categories.
Because there's a lot of movies.
You're right. Inside baseball, movies about journalism. There's movies in which journalism is the catalyst for the plot, which is a great catalyst, because if it's a love story or if it's an investigative thing, a journalist is almost as good as a detective. And movies in which the journalist is out for justice, the crusading journalist. And a lot of times these bleed into other things, which is our fourth category, movies in which the journalist becomes him or herself caught in the political intrigue.
And so we have an email. This is from a guy who says one of the best films about journalism that he likes is Broadcast News, where journalists Albert Brooks, Holly Hunter, William Hurt talk about journalistic ethics.
Here's a good one. They allow us to have cameras at an execution in Florida. Do you broadcast tape of the guy in the chair when they turn on the voltage?
Sure.
Why not?
Absolutely.
You bet.
Nothing like wrestling with a moral dilemma, is there?
Great patter you get in journalism movies, too.
It really is. And I think it was made in 1987, and somehow we were still in that era of, even though it's a good 15 years later, but almost 15 years, post-Watergate, where this was Washington media that was being portrayed, and there was something somewhat glamorous about it and hip about it.
We have somebody here on the microphone at the museum.
My name's Joan Bohr, and I'm from Livermore, California.
Thanks for coming.
And my favorite is His Girl Friday with Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell and Ralph Bellamy as the kind of wimpy fiancé.
The poor schlub of the fiancé. Here's Rosalind Russell saying goodbye to the life of a newspaper woman and to her unscrupulous editor and ex-husband, or so she thinks.
That's the story I just wrote. Yes, yes, I know we had a bargain. I just said I'd write it. I didn't say I wouldn't tear it up. It's all in little pieces now, Walter, and I hope to do the same for you someday. And that, my friends, is my farewell to the newspaper game. I'm going to be a woman, not a news-getting machine. I'm going to have babies and take care of them and give them cod liver oil and watch their teeth grow. And oh, dear, if I ever see one of them look at a newspaper again, I'm going to brain them. Where's my hat?
Does anybody ever talk that fast?
Well, in the front page they do. And this is there's a rock critic years ago named Ellen Wills, and she said the way you could tell if a rock lyric was sexist is if you could imagine a man or a woman singing it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a script by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, the front page, which works just as well, maybe better, with a female protagonist, Rosalind Russell, than it does with any number of male protagonists. It's been
well,
made
starting
many times.
With Pat O'Brien, when he was the original Hildy Johnson.
Yeah, exactly. On Broadway, though, it was a fellow named Lee Tracy, who was in a journalism movie of his own called Blessed Event. Maybe they were trying to cash in on his Hildy Johnson character. He talks faster than anybody.
He's a great fast talker. Yeah, yeah. It's a great loss when you can no longer wad up a story.
right. Hear that? That's my computer screen breaking.
There are also a bunch of films about people who write long-form journalism, not necessarily people on that daily deadline that provides so much opportunity for snappy patter. This is Capote. Philip Seymour Hoffman won an Oscar where he portrayed Truman Capote, and here he is in jail visiting with Perry Smith while he's working on what would become the book In Cold Blood. Well, he's still in the early stages.
I haven't written a word yet. What have you been doing? Research. Talking to you.
It's a wonderful Oscar-winning performance. There's another film, I mean, as it happened, and I think it was just chance and maybe bad luck for a movie called Infamous, but in 2005, there was a movie about this subject, Truman Capote and In Cold Blood, called Capote, we just heard from it, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then the next year, there was Infamous, starring Toby Jones. I haven't seen it, but some people prefer it. Mm.
Have you seen it, Brian?
Yeah, I have. I liked it. Toby Jones looks amazingly like Truman Capote. But Philip Seymour Hoffman was good, too. I wonder whether it's true that Capote's guilt over that story really ruined his life. You know, I mean, both movies sort of make the point that because he felt like he'd betrayed Perry Smith, he never wrote anything much again.
Right.
But I think he just drank himself.
Well,
journalism.
Right, which brings us back to Fill the Cup, your favorite James Cagney movie.
It's a combination newspaper movie and an alcoholism movie and a gangster movie.
Well, it makes sense to me. I don't know.
No, it's great stuff. It's great stuff, but it's not my actual favorite.
What's your favorite?
My favorite is The Great Man.
Oh, a radio movie.
A radio news movie with Jose Ferrer, Ed, and Keenan Wynn, both in the movie, Julie London. And it's a great picture.
It's 1956, and it's sort of anti-fascist movie, as I recall, right?
It's also a Romana Clef about Arthur Godfrey,
He's
supposed to be the great man. And Jose Ferrer, at the end of the movie, goes in and says, I can't read the script, and he throws it away, and he says, here's the truth about the great man. And then Keenan Wynn, as the agent, is standing in the network president's office. Dean Jaggart says, what are you doing? He says, I'm calling down to run the tape that we have ready, just in case he did this silly thing. He says, wait a minute, that's sincerity. We can sell that, too. It's a great film if you ever get the chance to see it. Here's Rory in Charlotte, North Carolina. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is his favorite. Simply Complex, a great film of life's great adventures in journalism. Might have been somewhat better organized.
Well, it's interesting. And by the way, we didn't mention documentaries, and there are a couple of those, including a couple of contemporary ones. We showed it at AFI at our Silver Docs Festival. Gonzo, The Life and Work of Hunter S. Thompson, and also Control Room, which is about Al Jazeera. But the Hunter S. Thompson story is an interesting and compelling one, and it reminds me, Neil, that some of the best filmmakers have turned their talents to this work. Occasionally we get a category like that, but that's a Terry Gilliam film. There's Frank Capra, Billy Wilder, Federico Fellini, Alfred Hitchcock,
Orson Welles.
Orson Welles had something to do with journalism. Yeah. An obscure little thing in 1941 that was nominated for an Oscar but didn't win.
And everybody says it's the greatest film ever, but you argue this is not really a film about journalism. It's just about William Randolph Hearst, one of the most important newspaper men of the century.
I think Citizen Kane, which happens to be, for you not with it, that the film we're talking about, it's about a great deal more than journalism. But again, it's one where journalism really is the catalyst, because Hearst was, whatever he wasn't, one of the things he wasn't was a newspaper man. He was a failure at many things.
Now, you were talking about the reporter as the crusader. Here's Jimmy Stewart as Chicago reporter P.J. McNeil, Lee J. Cobb as his editor here, doing his best to convince the reporter to follow up on one of his stories.
Maybe I'm interested for personal reasons. Maybe I'm interested because my mother did the same thing. She scrubbed floors in her hands and knees for more than 11 years, sent me through school.
Okay, I'll go out to the Pandemore and see him.
Kelly.
I happen to know that your mother had a small annuity. She never scrubbed a floor in her life. You never got past the fifth grade. But I figure if you pull such a corny gag as this, you must want me to go pretty bad, so I'm going. But I want you to know that you didn't get away with it.
There you go. Skepticism and corniness are a great pair. Yeah.
But did you ever actually talk to an editor that way?
I don't think I ever did. I don't know. Did you ever have a dramatic scene with an editor or publisher? Or a comic scene?
Oh, yeah, I imagine I did, but I don't Probably don't remember it.
We have two votes for Deadline USA, one from Larkin in Madison, Wisconsin, who says Bogart and Ethel Barrymore, a newspaper, faces a buyout, among other things, a great movie. And this email that we have, Humphrey Bogart, Ed Begley, Jim Backus, Big Trouble in the City Room, as the editor goes for broke in the 3 days before the newspaper is sold. Good, gritty film noir, and one of my favorites.
Yeah, and you can add three votes for that. This is one that I might think of as my favorite of all time. And unhappily, we couldn't get clips of it, but some of the dialogue is just too wonderful not to be believed in, to be included. One of them is, I'll never forget this line. I mean, it made a difference. It says, Bogart says, a profession is a performance for public good. That's why newspaper work is a profession. But maybe the best line is, he says, I don't like him. I'll think of a reason later. But here's one that he says that we excerpted, and see if this rings any contemporary bells. It's not enough anymore just to give them news. They want comics, contests, puzzles. They want to know how to bake a cake, win friends, and influence the future. Ergo, horoscopes, tips on the horses, interpretation of dreams so they can win on the numbers lottery. And if they accidentally stumble on the first page, news.
We're talking with Murray Horwitz about the great journalism movies of all time. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Roy Blunt Jr. is with us here as well. Murray Horwitz, of course, director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center here in the Washington, D.C. area. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there is, we're talking about some of the great inside baseball movies earlier. And there is one that, I know, Roy Blunt Jr., you have an opinion of it. We're going to play the famous clip from Peter Finch in the movie Network from 1976.
So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore!
I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore!
You know, my wife has still got her head out of the window. It's been 32 years, man.
But that's right? One of the least prophetic movies I've ever seen. Are we not taking it anymore? I don't know. And it's also just seems to me just sort of turgid melodrama and craziness. And also the cursing. Pauline Kael criticized the cheesy cursing in it. She thought that you'll never want to use the word blank, 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 blank again.
It's true. And does anybody remember that William Holden and Faye Dunaway and Robert Duvall were in this movie? I mean, all I remember is Peter Finch.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Nat. Mm-hmm. And Nat is with us from East Lansing in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi, Nat. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to put in a vote for All the President's Men.
All the President's Men. Well, we do happen to have a clip from that picture. Carl Bernstein has been helping Bob Woodward with his prose on the very first story they've written together. Woodward, played by Robert Redford, is not happy about the assistance.
If you're going to do it right. Here are my notes. If you're going to hype it with the facts. I don't mind what you did. I mind the way you did it.
Woodward. Bernstein, you're both on the story. Now, don't f*** it up.
That, of course, the famous moment when Woodstein was born.
Right, and, exactly so. My favorite compound word, I think, from that movie. Woodstein?
And we also got a nomination from that film from Lisa in Arlington, Virginia. Ben Bradley may be the first real guy who dwarfs the guy who plays him. Jason Robards, of course, played a great role as Ben Bradley in that movie.
And not easily dwarfed.
Not easily dwarfed, no.
It's probably the last contemporary film set in a city room. I mean, it may not be true, but you know, there aren't city rooms anymore. Ooh. You know,
they're cubicles these days,
and just everybody clicking away on a little, no typewriters.
Well, the one reason we ran that clip long was to run the sound of the newsroom.
Right, it was great to hear.
Yeah, I can remember newspapers when there actually was ink around. You get ink on the wall, and the people had whiskey in their drawers and things.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more fun.
Their desk drawers, I'm sure, is what he meant to say. Nat, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go now to let's go to Charlie. Charlie, with us from Wichita in Kansas.
This is a great topic, and I'll run off a bunch of titles of movies about newspaper chicanery. There would be Nothing Sacred with Frederick March. The remake of it with Martin and Lewis, with Living It Up with Janet Leigh, and the Frederick March role as a hard-boiled tabloid writer. And then Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas.
Those are all great choices. Nothing Sacred is one of my favorite films of all time. It's, again, one of those where the journalism's kind of the catalyst for the chase and what happens.
Right.
And Ace in the Hole has some great lines.
And here's one of them. This is from one of Billy Wilder's first movies, about a cynical, down-on-his-luck reporter played by Kirk Douglas. Here he is finagling a job at the Albuquerque Sun Bulletin.
Mr. Boot, I'm a $250-a-week newspaper man. I can be had for 50.
Why are you so good to me?
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
We just have a few seconds left. Murray, your favorite?
Oh, boy. This was really, really a hard one. There's one more category, by the way, which is La Dolce Vita, which somehow invented the word paparazzo. Yeah. But I think contemporary movies are really good. And I have to say, usually I go for the oldies, but Good Night and Good Luck, I think. And also, leave us not forget, Superman and Spider-Man, which have the classic editor-reporter or editor-photographer relationship.
Murray Horwitz, thanks as always for being with us. Murray Horwitz of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center. Our thanks too to Roy Blunt Jr., whose new book is Alphabet Juice, a regular panelist on a quiz show I seem to have had some familiarity with called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. They were both here with us at the museum. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.